netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hello and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our podcast today focuses on the animated film War Is Over, inspired by the music of John and Yoko, which took home the Best Animated Short Film Oscar this year. We've got four guests on this ep. First, we have Brad Booker and Dave Mullins from Electro League. Dave is the writer and director of the film, and Brad served as producer. Joining those two are Weta FX VFX supervisor Keith Miller and Weta FX animation supervisor Aiden Martin. They cover a lot of cool details about the film, including the real-time Unreal Engine aspect of the process, performance capture, how client review and approval was quite different using real-time, the balance between facial motion capture and animation played out, and even big script changes. So let's go ahead and cross to Mike and the guys.
So welcome, everybody. Dave, if I could start with you. Congratulations.
Yes, sir.
I guess this is the question that you get a lot, right? But I mean, just be honest here for a second. How confident were you going in?
What was great about this year, the other nominees, like there were the films that were in there were really fantastic. And one of the things I think we all liked was that each one of the films sort of touched on, not sort of, but they touched on serious subjects and very much took the medium of animation very seriously in telling their stories. And, you know, you look at Letter to a Pig, and it tells this really poetic story about, you know, surviving the Holocaust and how people feel about that. 95 Senses, you know, A Man on Death Row. I mean, Pachyderm, like they're, you know, My Uniform. They were all really strong films. And so our attitude, I think all of us, and correct me if I'm wrong here, guys, but I think our attitude is we were just very honored to be nominated, and that for us was the win that we got nominated and that we got recognized like that, because that's a very big deal to us. So the confidence going in, I mean, it's the Academy. You don't know where their mind is, how they're going to respond to the film. There's no like box office to look at. There's these small projects. And so we felt that we had made the best film we could, and we felt confident about that. As far as how people would respond to that, you just never know. So, you know, we were just excited. So I wouldn't say we were confident or not confident. We were just really excited to be there and be nominated.
It is quite a difference between the nomination process and the winning, right? The nomination process being much more kind of your peers and the, let's face it, I mean, no disrespect to the Oscars, right? And absolutely no disrespect to your team, but like it's a bit of a unknown quantity when it comes to the actual voting compared to when it comes to the process of the nomination. So I totally applaud your attitude in saying that the nomination was the win. Brad, could you just tell us for a second, how did you get from the initial meetings that you were having to connecting with Weta?
I think, you know, it happened pretty quickly, actually. I had worked at Weta 20 years ago, but Sean had just recently worked with Peter on the Get Back docuseries at Disney Plus. So, you know, the conversation started casually one night over a dinner that Dave and I had with Sean up in Northern California. And he's like, you know, maybe Peter'd be interested in reading this. And he started texting with him at dinner. And next thing you know, he's like, send us the script. We sent the script. And the next morning we woke up to a meeting or to a kind of a meeting request, but to Peter saying, look, I really like the script a lot. I'd love to jump on a Zoom tomorrow, which was on a Saturday for us, a Sunday for Peter and his team. So we literally met with Peter, Claire, his producer, and David Connolly, the head of Weta FX. And after a 2-hour Zoom session, you know, they were like, look, we want to do this for a lot of reasons. But I think, you know, obviously Weta wanted to get into animation and wanted to use this as kind of a calling card piece for them and trying to expand into not just visual effects, but into character animation, kind of the feature animation style of work. You know, it was a long journey, but you know, it ended quite well for us all, I think.
Brett, how long was that journey? Like, when did it sort of conclude to the point that you were releasing?
Yeah, so we started talking to Sean. Dave had kind of heard from Sean through a mutual friend at Pixar that Sean had produced his album. And, you know, that was like, we'll call it June of 2021. So it, you know, the initial meetings that we had were it all went pretty quick in terms of the story that, you know, Dave and Sean had initially talked about and that we all kind of got on board with. You know, we had two short meetings and then Dave went home and wrote the script that night, and it largely remained unchanged. I mean, with some minor third act tweaking that we did. Well, I don't know if minor is a good word, but
Aiden, would you say
some minor? Third act tweaking that we did. It was pretty much the same story, you know? So June of 21, and we finished in October of this year. So we'll call it, you know, almost 2.5 years. But it all happened naturally the way it needed to happen. So the story was as good as it could be. And I think everybody was really happy with the end result.
Yeah, I'm really interested to get into the process and the crafting of the film. But before we do, I did hear, Dave, that there was one sort of, I think you had a very supportive environment from everything I've heard, but there was like one point where you were sort of had a question over the script. Is that right? That where you were sort of like, other than that?
Oh yeah. I mean, I mean, I've worked on a lot of films. I've been working in film since like 91.
And may I say, some really great films.
Yeah, some pretty. I'm very pleased to have worked on them. I think the first actual feature I worked on was 95, which was Fantasia 2000. But, you know, being alongside those directors and producers and artists and watching the process, there's never a moment on the film that you don't have a moment where you have to reassess, you know, what your intention is for the film and what the film is actually telling you what it wants to be. Because, you know, I write the script, we go onto the Lightstorm stages and we shoot all the performance and then we put it up on reels. And, you know, you realize like, oh my God, the thing that was working really great on page isn't working great on screen. And I've seen this on every single film I've been on, like whether it's Nemo or, you know, Up or whatever it is. It's like, it's just every film is like that. And so we had that moment. And luckily it's that same time that Avatar needed resources from Weta. So we had like a little pause, like where we just put a pause on production for a minute. And that was, I think that was holiday 22. And so, you know, we went off and we saw that the third act wasn't working. The song wasn't landing and we couldn't find the right spot for it. The story wasn't delivering in what we all hoped it would be. So we went back, we rewrote it over the holiday break, and we came back in January and we're like, hey, Keith and Aiden, we rewrote the third act and here's the new third act. And they're like, what? But if we didn't listen to what the film was telling us, like you have to, like there's a process of getting the film up and on screen and like, you know, in whatever pre-production you're doing, there's that. And that's like this force of will that everybody does to make that happen. But once it's up on screen, then the film starts to tell you what it needs to be. If you can like take your own ego out of it, let's say like, oh, I created this or we created this, whatever it is. You put that aside and you just watch the film for what it is. It's like, this isn't working. And it's happened in every single film that I've worked on. And I found the films that have been more successful are the filmmakers that are willing to put their egos aside and say, all right, well, what do we do to fix this? And, you know, having great partners like Weta that saw that the film, you know, Keith, Aiden, Sophie, everybody saw David Conley, everybody saw that what we were pitching was a better version of the film. What was so great about them is the support we got from whatever they said, okay, we're going to roll up our sleeves. Aiden's going to go back on the capture stage with our cinematographer, David Scott, and Keith, and everybody is going to go and like rework the third act based off of what's been rewritten. And so we did that, and the film got exponentially stronger. It solved all these problems. There was emotional arc that wasn't coming through. The song was landing the right place. And when we did that, the song, the film became what we were hoping it could be. If that makes sense.
Yeah, well, as you've opened, let's unpack that a bit. So, and if I could talk to you about this, there was some motion capture at the beginning of the process, right? And then there was this new motion capture that we just heard discussed. Maybe you could just speak to the fact, because they were two quite different experiences from a animation supervision kind of point of view, weren't they?
Yeah, and I mean, I think Aiden can speak to this. I mean, what we shot on the LEI, the Lightstorm stages, was the script. But then once we rewrote it, we didn't have access back to Lightstorm. And so Aiden and Keith and their crew took what we wrote and, you know, some of the storyboards that we had, and took that and reshot that, and we reconstructed the third act. So, Aiden, you should speak to that.
Yeah. So it just like what Dave's saying is, the first iteration was certainly the first round of script notes and the first full script and some boards that Dave and Brad had from early on. And a lot of that stuff, you know, like once we put it all together, like after that whole experience of going through the full, because we went full facial capture and full body capture. And after we put all that stuff together, I think, you know, we also, not all of us, but we, you could tell something was either missing or the pacing didn't quite work once we had some of that stuff in there. And so we did a bit of an iterative process and recaptured some beats back here in Wellington, which was, for us, capturing it on the LEI stage or capturing on our stage here, we're very symbiotic with LEI, so the system's very similar. So their whole suits and their facial capture system is the same that we use here, because it's pretty much what LEI are using, pretty much what Weta developed. And we use the same capture engine over there, which is Giant. And once Dave and Brad had come back for that third act piece where the script was rewritten, and we had, it wasn't necessarily like it was totally different. It's just the pieces had moved around different. Some things got cut out. Some important events in the third act moved. And so for us to recapture again, it was, we knew where we were going because we'd already been there, and we had so much groundwork laid for the film already. We did it with a much smaller crew. I think I was probably, you know, soldier 02, 04 and 06 at some point. it was actually like once we came back to it and, you know, we were way more focused on where we were going with the story, it was a pretty seamless process for us to rebuild that again.
And you know, we had Unreal Engine in the mix later too. We didn't have the luxury of that at LEI just because of the nature of the time frame of the project. We hadn't done that initial legwork on prepping a lot of the assets. But later, at the later point where we needed to do kind of pickup captures and recapture here, a lot of that stuff was quite developed. So we were able to kind of, you know, a little bit of optimization, load all that stuff up in Engine, visualize, you know, in the context of the environments with the lighting and everything, which is always a really helpful thing to have that context.
Costumes, dynamic costumes, lighting in the, you know, in the actual environment that you are supposed to be, you know, that the film will be seen in. We had, we could actually visualize that at the end in that last.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Keith, because as I understand it, because you had that sort of setup, and especially in environment work in Unreal, you were sort of basically able to change the approach a little bit for that second round. Is that right?
Yeah. So like I said, I think most of that later capture was, you know, largely a singular environment, right? It was primarily trench and
it
battle.
It was all between the trenches. Yeah. So no man's land in between the trenches.
Yeah. So we could really just focus on preparing that one environment for the real-time work on the stage, because, you know, the project itself, you know, was more near real-time than real-time, you know, because we knew it was going to be an offline rendered piece at the end of the day. We didn't need to like do all that upfront legwork to make sure everything was, you know, running at 30 FPS. obviously on the stage, you have slightly different requirements. So we just needed to do a little bit of optimization for that one environment, essentially, to kind of prep that. But it was not too bad.
Well, so Brad, yesterday I was talking to Kim Labrerie at Epic Games, and Kim obviously super happy for everything that's happened with you guys and incredibly enthusiastic about the end result of the film. But Brad, if I could just ask you like a more fundamental question, like why did you end up with Unreal in the first place? Was that coming from you, or did you like end up talking to Weta and they went, hey, what about Unreal Engine? Like where did that come into the mix?
Yeah, even before we met up with Peter and the whole Weta thing clicked into place, the initial formation of Electro League was always meant to be a real-time workflow. So for Dave and I, it's really important to, you know, have a stage, and we'll, I think we'll continue to hone it as we move forward. But, you know, we want, and you know, the storyboarding process is a beautiful art form in and of itself, but I think we now believe that using this kind of real-time workflow, not only can you move faster, but you're wasting zero because you're everything that you're doing is contributing to the final pixel of the film. Whereas in storyboarding, you know, as beautiful as it is, you are going to throw it away at some point and then go into CG. So for us, the whole idea was, you know, and it was like when we were working with Weta and the fact that we were trying to initially get the film done for the end of 2022, we had to rush some stuff to be able to shoot the capture here in Los Angeles on the LEI stage. But the initial plan and moving forward is always going to be get your assets, at least some rough versions of the assets done up front that you can use as almost, you know, we kind of refer to it as Legos, where you, you know, like your box of Legos, where you can bring those assets in and just go on the capture stage and start realizing your film and shoot it more like a live action film. So instead of taking 6 months to get a feature film up, you could do it in 30 to 45 days. And then, you know, everything after that, you've already gained, you know, we'll call it three and a half, 4 months. And then it becomes a very iterative process after that. So that's what's exciting to us as filmmakers. And, you know, the kind of content that Dave and I want to make is edgier, kind of aged up stuff. So for us, it's really about, you know, keeping costs and the time frame down while maintaining the quality. So we believe that's the future for us as a company, and yeah, it'll allow us to keep the kind of content.
It also has everything that Brad's saying. It also has a stylistic impact on the film. There is something about shooting actual actors, having a virtual camera that you have in your hands or, you know, on, you know, rigs or whatever it is, it grounds it a lot more. And so the types of stories we want to tell tend to be more grounded, like kind of dramatic, kind of action. And it really lends itself to that. I mean, there's great work being done in animation that is, you know, your traditional layout where everything's inside the box, but there's something really gritty is the wrong word, but there's something very
more like tactile,
and real is the wrong word. Yeah, tactile is a great way of putting it, because what you're always trying to do with CG is you're always trying to keep the box from making everything perfect, which means it does, you know, perfect textures, it does perfect lighting, it does perfect surfaces. We're always trying to scuff that stuff up to make it feel real, because everything in life is scuffed up a bit. And so there's something about being on set with the actors with a real camera that it just gives it, like, it just grounds it in a way. You know, we can still do like crazy camera moves and all that, of course, but there's just, I think it just lends itself stylistically to what we're trying to do. And ground it and make it feel more believable, I think is the word.
You were in an interview a little while ago, and you said that you always treated animators as actors, which was just music to my ears, right? Because I think that's one of the huge misnomers, just that people skip over the acting part of the animation process. On this process, you had some actual mocap actors, but then of course you also had the animators as actors. Did you find any difference? Because obviously you've done a lot of big Pixar films and stuff. Do you find any difference being with that Unreal kind of time frame and iterative loop? Or Dave, was it just the same as doing sort of more traditional RenderMan type stuff?
I mean, I think that like whenever you're talking to your performers, and whether that is an animator or that's an actor that you're capturing, it's all the same language. I mean, you're talking about interior monologue and intent, and you know, we're thinking about staging, and you know, all these things are, they're just the same, you know. And what was great about being at Pixar for 20 years was that we treated animation very seriously. It wasn't all like, it was a lot of funny stuff, but we always thought about what the intention of where it's coming from and how you're building from the character. Less is more, like all the things that you try and do on screen. And the thing that was great about working with Aiden was he's got such a good sense of not only, you know, sort of how you approach things sort of physically and mechanically, but also this great sense of how you approach things from an acting standpoint, which is how do you get those, deliver those performances in a way that's going to make the most impact on the audience, to get the audience to connect. So Aiden and I connected very strongly over that pretty much right up front. And I felt the same way when I was working with Kevin Dorman and his team that were the were the actors that we used on the film. We just all spoke, we all spoke the same language. It didn't matter if we were animator, director, or actor, it's all the same language. And it's really about those artists and how they approach their craft.
Yeah, yeah. Keith, if I can geek out with you for a second on just the look, what was really distinctive about the film is it had this stylized aspect to it. There's particularly this sort of like outline in black that would appear occasionally just slightly offset from the characters and stuff. Can you talk to that, where that came from and just how easy it was to pull off? Because it's such a distinctive and an effective tool.
Yeah, obviously, you know, Zach Retz, the production designer, came with some amazing artwork. That was the starting point for it. And I think, you know, there was just really brilliant, you know, line work, brush work in that stuff. And we had a number of conversations with, you know, Brad and Dave about that artwork and, you know, what are the important elements to preserve? Where do we want to start to, you know, riff off of things and explore? What are the things we need to take into consideration once we're adapting 2D artwork into something that works, you know, three-dimensionally and spatially? You know, once we've got things moving around and cameras flying around through that space. So, you know, there was a kind of discovery phase early on where we're just kind of riffing off of Zach's artwork. And I think, you know, for me as a, you know, as a visual effects supervisor on the, you know, feature film side for so many years, you know, you're often looking at, you know, what's often painterly artwork and trying to understand how do you translate that painterly concept, you know, into something that's more photoreal. And in this case, we're trying to take, you know, a painterly concept and preserve that painterly feeling to it and just translate it into something that kind of moves and breathes and feels like we're inside of a living piece of concept painting. And that was one of the things that Dave always said early on. You know, he wanted to make sure that it felt like we were inside of a living concept painting. And we found a number of techniques to feel our way there. And it was really about just trying to, you know, trying to make it feel like it wasn't just, you know, painted textures that were kind of, you know, stenciled onto the characters. You know, I think we've seen that a lot in a number of other, you know, kind of recent animated work. We wanted this to feel like it was a painting, you know, and we did lots of tricks to kind of like have dynamic kind of brushwork, you know, really dynamic line work, and really kind of harken back to, you know, the beauty of the, you know, the two-dimensional and you know, art reference pieces that, you know, we were all inspired by.
Dave, do you want to add to that in terms of the realization of that that look? Because it is so distinctive, and I think it works so effectively as well.
Yeah, you know, I agree with everything that Keith just said. And, you know, one of the things that Brad and I have been wanting to do with Electro League from day one is that, you know, we knew we had to have a distinctive look for our films, and that's something we're still very much after. You know, Brad and I both come from animation, so we have a really strong appreciation for 2D animation. We studied 2D animation before we were ever 3D, you know, computer animators. And so for me, I studied painting in college. Like, that's my background, is painting and color theory. And, you know, the artists that I love, I really leaned on the artists that I love from the era that we're in. So we're in World War One, and around that era, you know, we had J.C. Leyendecker was doing a lot of paintings. He did a lot of ad work, but his paintings are just so, have such a strong brush quality to them that I really love. That, you know, Brad and I both love. And also thinking about Norman Rockwell and the way that he draws, his paintings are almost, you know, drawings, you know, he draws and then paints, and just the caricature that he would get. So when it came to that style, you know, we went to Zach and we said, look, you know, we love your style. When you're doing your paintings and you're doing your own personal work, we want to marry that by keeping Leyendecker and Rockwell in mind. When you do that, could you bring forward a style that kind of gives us that feeling but has your own hand in it, which he did beautifully. And then Max Narciso was our character designer, and this guy can draw anything masterfully, like just an incredible character designer. And what we wanted to preserve really was also, you know, the outline. So we had like an outline on the characters, but we also had drawings inside the surface of the characters that were just always on the surface of the characters. And that was kind of a love letter to, you know, our 2D animation upbringing that we had, you know, Disney and Miyazaki and all the other animators that we love. So it was kind of a marriage of all those things. And then we kind of bring this to Keith and team and, you know, say, hey, we really want to preserve this. We don't want this to go away. And they did such a good job of doing that. And I think, you know, like there's so many, like just like the skies, like so many of those skies are hand painted. Some of them are directly from Zach. Some of them are Thelvin and his team doing great work of interpreting it and extending. Like, I know, Keith, you extended skies all the time just yourself. So there was this great marriage between our production design, our intent, and what Weta was doing. And it was just so impressive to see the style represented on screen in a way that isn't distracting and weird. Because like Keith was referring to earlier, a lot of times when people try to do this painterly style, it's like really distracting. It's like your eyes are almost screaming sometimes.
It's really funny you say that, Dave, because when I was watching it, I was trying to watch the puffs of kind of explosion in the air as the pigeons flying through, because I'm thinking to myself, there's something interesting going on there. But I was trying to distract myself to look at those because I was so interested in what was actually going on with the narrative story flow that I was like, wait, go back, kind of thing. Like, I just wanted to move my eye away from where you've clearly directed me to look, because even those had this kind of painterly, almost inky feel, which are, I mean, obviously not as central to maybe some of the characters, but just gorgeous in this kind of realization.
Well, that was a crazy thing we asked of Weta. And like, I remember the conversation we were having when, you know, I said to you, Keith, I was like, we want these explosions to look like paintings. And you're like, I'll try not to swear right now, but it's like, what the hell, man, what are you talking about? And they figured it out in such an aesthetically pleasing way that, you know, I don't even know what voodoo you guys do, but it's just so impressed with it. So it can be so distracting, and it just feels like it's such part of the frame in such an aesthetic way. So yeah, it's like, that's like every little thing, like we want everything to feel like a painting.
So I'm going to switch gears a second now and just talk to Keith and Brad about the production cycle, because it was really interesting in interview that you did earlier, Keith. You mentioned that actually supervising the project was different because the iterative speed of which you could do stuff. I think you joked that someone actually during dailies fixed a shot that you'd commented on at the beginning of dailies, kind of thing, right? So I want to get your opinion on that, and then I'll go to Brad about what's like as a client getting those kind of quick iterations. But Keith, lead off, like, what was that? You said you actually had to change your sort of supervision style.
Yeah. I mean, the sheer volume of what was being produced once the machine was up and running, and we did spend, you know, a lot of time kind of setting up the pipeline to that point. But once it's there, the efficiencies of real time really come to light. And, you know, often in visual effects, you have to work so efficiently, right? It's like, okay, we're going to render a single frame, get this approved. Now we might run it on fives or tens and then evens or odds. You know, you have to be really conscious of how much of the render wall you're using when it's in competition with all the other projects in-house. This is not that, right? Like, artists are able to quickly jump from, you know, single shot to running out their a batch of shots, you know, and so they could run an entire sequence at a time, you know. And, you know, when you're seeing that much volume, you can't kind of noodle on the specific details that you would have focused on as a, you know, if you're just seeing a single frame, you know, for weeks before you're moving that on to evens or odds or seeing much more output. So, you know, I just had to start to change the way I prioritized the notes a little bit to some degree, and just start to think of things a little bit more cohesively as like, you know, what's the big picture across this entire sequence of shots that I'm seeing rendered, as opposed to like, you know, noodling, you know, the pixels, you know, down on an individual kind of shot level. And yeah, it definitely did happen many times where, you know, I give a note at the beginning of dailies and, you know, before the end of dailies is over, they've turned the note around and re-rendered it, put it back into shot sub for us, you know.
Brad, does it change how you produce a show? Because like, it's in the old days, you could kind of go, well, look, and I mean, I'm not speaking specifically about any of your films, but you'd be like, okay, you get sort of three passes at this shot as an animation kind of review. And then let's face it, we're into overages, right? Whereas Brad, you could be like, well, could you just change that? And based on what Keith just said, they'd change it kind of on the spot. Did you run the project a lot differently?
We did. I think, you know, it took a while for us because this is such a unique situation. We weren't really a paying client because Peter wanted to help out on this project. And it just really was kind of this very unique hybrid situation. And I think it took a while for us to figure out what that production workflow was in terms of how many times we get to see a shot. And, you know, to Keith's credit and Sophie Cherry, the producer on their side, like they really worked with us. And, you know, Dave and I are used to working mostly, we've worked on visual effects films. And I think, you know, the lion's share, you know, almost all the work that Weta's done in the past tends to be, and Keith, please correct me if I'm misspeaking here, but it tends to be like, okay, we're going to do, you know, 750 shots on this film and we get the plates and it's a very finite thing. Whereas when you're working on, we'll call it feature animation for lack of a better term, but the kind of animated living beast that is one of these things, it's changing all the time. Like, you know, as nailed down as a script can be, where, you know, it's not the same where you go shoot something live action and just hand plates over. It is something that you're creating together. And you know, you used the word client earlier. I don't think Dave and I ever thought of ourselves as clients. We thought of ourselves as just the director and producer on a project that Weta was working on. Like,
partners.
It felt like we were one big cohesive team. And, you know, there were some things that we had to figure out, and it worked against, you know, the cost effectiveness of this sometimes, but it really is a very different way of working when you're making an animated film versus a live action visual effects film. So hats off to these guys for really kind of rolling with it, you know?
Aiden, can I swing back to you on the technical side of things? Because I wanted to not interrupt the guys before, but we were talking about doing facial capture and a bunch of stuff that clearly involved Atlas and Gazebo and stuff. Could you just talk to me about like getting from there, which, you know, if you're going for a photoreal face, we have like a classic kind of, okay, well, this is what the person actually looks like, so let's put it up beside a photo and get there. How did you, because you're stylistically, you're using these tools, but you don't have a photoreal target. Can you just discuss getting those performances and how that technically went through your pipeline?
Sure. So, we definitely started with the facial capture from that first LEI capture session. And our plan was to track those faces, put them on the you know, the stylized characters, and I wasn't thinking like we'll see what we get. Like we were planning on using those performances, but I think it quickly turned in. We quickly realized that we weren't quite hitting the aesthetic nature of the facial performances if we went with straight capture. So we actually, we moved away from the facial capture and we went with a more traditional.
So the actors had head mounted, cameras.
Head cams.
And so you're resolving that to a model of that actor before you do the retargeting, like traditionally?
No, we were going straight.
Retargeting it straight. And then you sort of moved from that to being less of a specific and more, because of the stylized than the retargeting, or was it just literally that you felt like the what you could get out of the animated characters was different than what you could get out of the retargeted stuff?
It was purely the level of performance that we were getting, because you would put the tracked data onto the faces and we couldn't push it far enough. And then we found that what we were doing was animating so much to camera and pushing Dave was really big into finding the right sort of aesthetic look to a frame, for instance, like one specific frame. So in reviews, David landed a frame and he would just start to tweak and draw over lines and just trying to get the right appeal on a face. And we found it was way quicker if we went actually with a more 2D approach to the facial than if we went from motion capture data onto the face and then tried to apply those sort of aesthetics. We just went straight to, we went from a motion capture setup to actually having, we made character sheets with, maybe 12 different expressions. And of those character sheets, we could then make sure that they looked really good in a 2D sense which also helped to sort of drill down on each individual character and what their expression was like in that moment. And then we made a big list of, pose shapes in the library. And so from each angle, we could make that pose read. And we just found it was way more efficient to start from there. And we would get less Dave notes, especially on face feel, rather than starting with capture data.
Because it's not a dialogue heavy problem, Dave. It's a subtext problem on the facial expressions of the characters, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all about, appeal. And I know appeal, this word gets thrown around a lot in the animation community and people tend not to explain what that means, but it is literally how the lines are or the features are aligning on screen to make something, you can look at something and go, that looks really great. It could be the same character, the same model. And then if, it's not enough in profile, or if the nasal labial fold's not doing the right thing, or the eye isn't just the right place, suddenly it starts to feel off. And this is what I've done my entire career, is focus on the appeal of animation. And so I wasn't, probably to Aiden's chagrin a little bit, I wasn't as concerned about what we got in capture. I was more concerned about what the final frame would look like. And once we got past that barrier of, oh, you're not talking about just taking the capture and putting it on screen. You're talking, and I'm not saying that that's what you guys do at all with Avatar or any of the projects you work on, because I know how much your hand's in there. But for this, it was more of a traditional animation aesthetic we were trying to bring to screen. So with that, we use Sync Sketch and, it's just me drawing over and drawing over to make sure that what I'm looking for, I'm able to communicate that in the quickest way possible. So, it's not like some big guessing game. I'm not talking about fluffy clouds up in the sky of it's got to be more happy. It's like, no, if you do this and this and this, it'll get kind of more of that specific feeling we're looking like here. And a lot of our conversations were based off of performance, was really for animation was concerned with performance and then appeal. And that was really great working with Aiden and his team in those regards, because they just soaked it up like a sponge. Like everything I threw at them, they were so eager to sort of take the information and then plus it. And so many great performances were just brought. I felt, correct me if I'm wrong, boy, my voice just cracked there, but correct me if I'm wrong, Aiden, towards the back half of the show, and this typically happens on any animated project, towards the back half of the show, I felt like the stuff that I was trying to communicate early in the process, then kind of clicks in and you guys get ahead of it. And then you're bringing these great performances with all the, you know, kind of, we kind of hit like that critical mass of like, okay, we all understand what the appeal is. And then it kind of speeds up, but it takes a lot in the beginning to kind of nail down that appeal, because it is very personal to the director, the anime supervisor. And, you know, it was just a conversation we had to have and work out. And, you know, by the end of the film, it's just like, it comes in, it's like, it's great, it's great, it's great, it's great, it's great. You know, it's like, it's faster.
Keith, it must be really beneficial having a director with direct animation experience and that paint over that we just touched on briefly there, right? Like, I mean, that is an incredibly informative way of communicating what's required, as opposed to make it more esoteric, make it more organic, you know, the kind of words that get thrown around. Could you talk to that? And also, I guess one thing that I was interested in is like how far those animation controls allowed you to get there inside Engine, or were you having, because I know that you've spoken that you're going to look more about animation rig controls in the future. So like, get, like, you've got that really informative visual from Dave, which sounds brilliant, but then you've got to make that happen. Did you have the tools just in your normal pipeline, or was it in Unreal? Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So I'll divide that up into two discussion points. So in terms of the paint over aspect, you know, kind of Dave painting over, you know, the animation review material, you know, the paint overs also applied to, you know, the lighting and rendering process as well too. So we'd often, you know, we're setting up a new look for an environment, new lighting scenario. We render that out. And then Zach Retz would basically take those renders and just do additional kind of paint work on top of it, add a little bit more light here, maybe push the saturation a little bit more here and send that back to us. And, you know, again, you're translating a 2D painting back into something that's based on, you know, kind of plausible lighting with lumen and everything. So there was always like a find the right elements to kind of extract from, you know, the intent of Zach and Dave and the intent of their paint over and how we kind of integrate that into 3D. So we were able to kind of iterate across those kind of paint over images on the lighting as well. With respect to the animation pipeline, so the animation work all happened inside the traditional kind of Weta workflow. So in that sense, the work was kind of split across the real-time side of things and then all the work that's happening inside of, you know, our Olympus pipeline, animators using all of their, you know, known kind of proprietary tools and processes and everything. We just knew that the volume of work, you know, this was not the right project to kind of take this on as like a control rig type scenario. But also one of the goals with the look of the characters was that we wanted realistic looking kind of cloth simulation on this stuff. So, you know, we played with a few things. We played with the, you know, machine learning deformer and Engine and, you know, some other tricks there. But we've ultimately settled on a process where we were going to, you know, publish that animation out and just bake it and run it through our creature pipeline. And then we just basically took in the geometry caches, Alembic caches into Engine. So all of that stuff was basically cache geometry. So it did mean that we had to kind of span, you know, the resources and the workflows across both environments. You know, like the animators need, you know, a red carpet area. They need, you know, they need to understand what the characters are contacting. But we also, on the Unreal side, we're trying to like dress things just in Engine that the animators didn't have, you know, visuals on and a representation of. So we were always having to just do this little bit of this balancing act of like, okay, what do we bubble up from the Engine so that Aiden and his team can see it? And what are the changes that Aiden and team need to make to the world that we need to carry back down? So it was just conscious, you know, trying to be conscious of that.
So in finishing up, if I could just go around the four of you, I'd really like to get your perspective, like lessons learned almost, but if I could frame it and I'll work my way from you, Keith, right back to Dave at the end. It's just basically, I guess, if you could go and talk to yourself at the beginning of the project, like what advice would you give to yourself or what you kind of like lessons learned? Because I think that this is a significant piece. It's a creatively brilliant piece, but it's also like a really interesting piece for advancing this style of work, and clearly both Brad and Dave are interested in doing more of this. So what are the kind of lessons? So what would you do differently or tell yourself, Keith, if I can start with you and we'll work our way around the room?
You can't say walk away. That's not the advice.
You know what? Like if when I look at the project, I mean, I think there were probably some technical decisions around the pipeline and just some of the ways that we maybe approach things in trying to develop the look that I would just probably re-engineer in a slightly different way to make things just even that much more efficient. But for the large part, you know, like I think it was a very well crafted and well executed kind of pipeline that was really perfect for the scale and the scope and the ambition of this project. So I think, you know, going forward, obviously plenty of, you know, advances in Unreal Engine. You know, we were just on Unreal 5 at the time. So, you know, with 5.4 bringing so much more to the table, you know, we already are seeing ways to actually just completely restructure, throw away huge chunks of what we did and use a new kind of simplified methodology for achieving the exact same kind of thing. So that stuff's always going to get a little bit easier.
Aidan, from an animator's point of view or your
point of view? Well, yeah. So for me, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but I guess for me, it was less of a technical, I wouldn't be giving myself any technical advice because I feel like, as Keith mentioned before, like the animation, we were blessed with the fact that we didn't actually have to change our approach too much to how our normal Weta pipeline is. But I think artistically, from my point of view, if I could go back to the start, I would say just be brave and trust your instincts, because I think what, you know, Dave was saying before about, you know, like the last sort of third of the film when we were sort of like, we hit our stride and things were really happening. It's like, that's the point where I feel like I kind of found a bit more confidence in like, okay, you know what you're doing. Dave and I had more of an established relationship where we were like, okay, yep, the trust, we know what we're doing. When we trust each other, where we're going. So I would just say creatively trust your instincts and just go with it, you know, like that's what the advice I would give myself. Cause I feel like, maybe at the start, I didn't know what I was getting myself into, so I wasn't quite aware of what I would have to bring to the table, I think.
So, Brad, you mentioned before that you were keen to do more of this work, and we hope that you do. So in approaching these sorts of projects, any advice to yourself?
I think the only big thing that I would do differently is I think both Sophie and I really – I think we knew in the back of our minds that we would never get this thing done for 2022. And I think rushing it to try to do so hurt us in a lot of ways, but it is what it is. There were a lot of people that really wanted to see us get it done by the end of 22. I think it would have changed our workflow quite a bit. And Keith, you know, tell me if I'm wrong there, but I just feel like we rushed to get, we were under this false deadline and we rushed to get stuff done for the Avatar stage. You know, we really wanted to shoot the first bit of it there. And I think if we would have just waited, we could have had a really kind of slick, the pipeline that Keith and Aidan found later, where they did the reshoots, where everything was kind of real time in Unreal. Where we weren't so dependent on the giant stuff. I think that's the only thing I would change. I think otherwise everything happened exactly the way it should have happened. You know, we're proud to have worked with Weta on this. We're, you know, we had Lightstorm involved, we had Epic Games involved, and we landed people like Thomas Newman, you know, 15-time Oscar nominee to do the music for it. So the score for it. So, I mean, look, how could we not all be proud of that? It's a special project, and it turned out exactly the way we all hoped it would.
Dave?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, you know, I should be self-reflective enough to go back and recognize all the errors and problems that I brought to the table. But I have to be really honest. Like, this is the best experience that I've had making a film. Like, as an animator, as a writer, director, whatever, it's like it is literally the best experience I had in every single day I was on the film. I felt that way. I'd say, you know, sort of selfishly, if I was going to go back and give myself some advice, I would say, make sure Winston and Abel fight in the third act so we don't have to rewrite the third act. But that's kind of a creative thing. I mean, it's tough. I mean, probably, you know, Keith and Aiden and Brad, you could probably answer this, probably give me advice, maybe things I don't see, but I was so happy every day on it with everybody that I'm not sure there's much I would change.
Well, let me clarify my question then and say, would you do a feature this way?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's what we want to do.
Yeah, you think it would scale and it would work as well?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. Keith and Aiden would have
creatively. Technically, I think there's probably some work we've got to do to scale. I mean, it was our biggest Unreal, you know, kind of linear project to date. Obviously, you know, building off of like Meerkat and other kind of smaller shorts. You know, 10 minutes was quite a bit. We pushed the engine in a lot of ways, and we've been talking to Epic about, you know, where we would like to take the engine and make improvements and advancements to turn, you know, 10 minutes into 90 minutes. And it's very possible. I think I see that path. I see it happening. And I think it's only a matter of time really before, you know, we're probably there.
Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, I guess we should finish by just pointing to the fact that in addition to everything else that we've discussed, you were finishing musically on such an incredibly strong note in something that resonated with audiences around the world and has for many decades. So yeah, it was a brilliant project. Guys, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about this. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Appreciate it.
Thanks so much to the guys for chatting with us. It was interesting to hear how the real-time process impacted the pipeline and also how it will likely impact things moving forward using the same kind of real-time processes. Well, that's it for this episode of the FX Podcast. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.